everybody, this is my long lost friend Tuan. We were college. I was going to say roommates. We were fraternity brothers at Tulane, where we supposedly studied. So actually, it's a Tulane 3-0 here. Because Andy, you're also an alum. This is kind of a reunion of sorts because Tuan and I haven't really connected in 25. I'm not going to age. Because you look like you're literally 19 still, dude. How did you pull that off?
It's the filter. There's technology, man.
Hey everybody, I'm Evan Farmer, and welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm here with my co-host, Andy, and we're here to interview people who have literally lost everything and survived to tell us how they rebuilt.
I'm Andy, and we're diving into the human side of disaster recovery. The grief, the grit, and the guts it takes to start over.
Alright, so thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump into today's episode. Hey, if you shop at Home Depot, this is a no-brainer. Our free Build SOS program unlocks verified discounts, often up to 30%, plus access to exclusive deals on tools and materials. It is especially useful for contractors, handymen, and DIYers who buy regularly. No fees, no gimmicks, just better prices at checkout. All you have to do is click the link below or in the show notes that says Build SOS with Home Depot to start saving. Welcome to Disaster Diaries. I'm Evan Farmer. Today's guest and I go back to our fraternity days at Tulane University in New Orleans. Throw in Andy, and that's a trio of Tulane alums. Here's our conversation with my good friend Tuan, who lost his house in the Eaton Canyon fire in Altadena, California. You've just went through one of the most challenging things I think people can go through, because I know I've been there. Andy's been through it. So let's start from the beginning, man. Tell me about the day just before everything happened and kind of walk us through what happened.
Yeah, so probably started the day prior. During the time, we were having 120-mile-an-hour winds, very reminiscent of New Orleans, being us Tulane alumni. And so I was telling my wife, man, if we get any type of spark out here, we don't have a chance because these winds are crazy. Our palm trees were going 90 degrees. So the next day, I'm watching the news about the Palisades fire, which is across the city from us, and I get a call from my real estate agent who helped us buy the house. And she was like, "Are you guys okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, we're fine. You know, everything's normal." She goes, "Well, there's a fire at Eaton Canyon, which is about 2 miles, 3 miles from my house." And being the good southern transplant that I am, I built a nice deck in front of my yard. So I go out there, and on this deck, I can see what it's an orange glow, and it looked like the sun was setting. And I told my wife, I was like, "We have half an hour if that thing flips." Because at the time, the wind was going southeast. We're a little southwest of the area. And I was like, if that wind flips, we're toast. And in my mind, at that point, all I could think about was the Paradise fires, which happened in California. And it happened also on a mountainside, but it was a smaller community. One road in, one road out. And there's actual footage of people like burning alive in their cars, people running down the streets and, you know, dying.
I remember
way down. And I was like, that's not happening to my family. So we called the sheriff's department. There was no official notification. And as a family, we're like, we're just going to leave. That's about 8:45, probably about 45 minutes after my phone call with my real estate agent. We're heading down the road and you could just see what essentially was like lava flow of burn area, and from that day we didn't come back to the property for 6 weeks.
In that moment, though, were you talking to to your wife and also to your kids about, hey, why don't you go grab some things, right? I mean, where do you have that balance between, I'm not gonna freak you out and tell you to grab everything important and put it in the car in 5 minutes, but at the same time, was that running through your mind of like, let's grab some of the important things?
I treated it as if it was right across the street. We the just fire. Moved into the we just moved into the house, so all of our important stuff was in a central area. It's not like we could have just walked over there. Looking back, we could have packed our like three cars and then, you know, had as much of our stuff as possible, you know, but that's with the ability to look back, you know. At the moment, I was just thinking we're all going to roast. So I can have a conversation with people about, you know, my wife's Louis Vuitton bags. I can't have a conversation about, hey, you know, all three of my family members died because I wanted to get, you know, my golf bag out. So there was none of that. After the fire, one of my my kid's friends sent him a uplifting message. And it was like literally right after the fire, and it was like, you know, from the ashes you shall rise. And we're like, yeah, that's probably like a little too soon. But now that it's almost 9 months later, you know, we're rebuilding the things that, you know, we've lost bit by bit. And, but, you know, every one of the people who are important to me are helping me rebuild it. You know, there's nobody missing. That was my only concern.
What was it like when you, the moment you realized, oh, my house is actually gone or probably going to be gone?
Well, okay. So the next morning, we drove, we left the hotel, and we decided we're going to go to my sister-in-law, who lives like 2 hours away in Palm Springs, Palm Desert area. And we figured there's going to be a mess up there anyway, so we didn't want to come back in terms of, like, but we were just thinking smoke and things like that. We weren't thinking our house was going to burn up. But then my wife got a video, I got a call from an old neighbor who's a plumber, and he was sent up here to turn off a lot of gas lines. And so he was like, hey, do you want me to go up to your house? I'm like, yeah, sure. So he recorded it. When he sent it to us, my first initial, thought was, where is he? Because I couldn't locate what, he, you know, he was just driving around. Everything was gone. And so I'm like, where is he? And then he turned, you know, then you see him turning, and then he turned down my street. And down my street, like, the first house was this really nice house that had just been built, and it had this beautiful driveway with fresh lawn. And I saw that, and I turned off the video. I didn't even wait to see, like, the very ending, because I knew there was nothing there. I knew there was nothing there for miles, not, like, you know, on my block. I saw that house. I was like, there's nothing there for blocks and blocks and blocks. I don't want to even look at it. I didn't actually see the physical property until 6 weeks after the fire, because we were like, there's nothing to see. You know, if there's things left, I don't even want to like sift through it to it, because I just like, maybe I didn't want to be reminded of it. I didn't want to, it was like a futile process. You know, what am I sifting through? Just dust and ashes to hopefully find, you know, a stupid ring or something. We just forego the whole process, and so we didn't come back for 6 weeks.
Was there a difference with, I mean, there's you and how you handle it, and then there's your family, right? So did you find yourself in a position where you were trying to have like meaning making for your kids, or a different perspective than your wife?
Like, I went into rebuild mode right away. My kids are going to the same school, so they, you know, they didn't lose their friends or anything like that. So they just, you know, they settled into that stuff. But, you know, I think my wife, it hit her the most. And I'll share a story that I remember. Well, so we're sitting at my sister-in-law's, and we just found out. And I go straight into, hey, what should we do about these doors? Man, we hated this one part of the bathroom. And I'm like, you know what, when we do this, this is what we should do. And I'm sitting there making all these plans. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be like the next, you know, Eichler. I'm gonna have Martha Stewart putting me on their, you know, magazines and stuff. And she yelled at me. She's like, just screamed at me. All my wife wanted was a hug. You know, all she wanted me to do was just hold her and kind of let her process, you know. So, but on the other hand, my going into rebuild mode was my process. You know, my son went deep into his guitar, so I don't know if that was his processing. We've never really discussed it as a family, because we've all been in life mode. Life goes on, right? We still have bills. People still expect you to go to work. Everybody has their own way of it hits them. You know, like as adults, my wife and I are dealing with it differently than the kids. We know people who are having marital issues because of this. And it's because all of us are going through it separately, and a lot of us might not really want to talk about it. Like my family, I don't think they want to talk about it.
I think it's pretty awesome that you recognize that as a family, that everybody's got their own thing. And it sounds like you guys kind of respected each other's process as well, which is something that I think everybody gets, you know, it gets overlooked, is that whole, you got to do it your way.
Absolutely. And it just doesn't apply to my family. And it applies to everybody that I know that is dealing with this. You know, I'm trying to apply as much grace to people's how they're reacting to all of this. Because, like, you know, I'm on all these social media sites, and a lot of it is for information, a lot of it is for support. And you get a lot of, like, you get a lot of just, I want to say, energies that are very negative, that aren't very good for the process. But I try to be very empathetic, because I don't know what exactly they are dealing with, you know. I don't know if their insurance is paid out. I don't know their grief.
Is that like a misery loves company thing, or so, you know, some people process through you know, anger or frustration? Is it?
The latter. Yeah. It's not misery loves company, because I don't find any comfort in the fact that other people are miserable. I'd rather be miserable alone in this situation. If I had it my way, I'd rather it just be my house.
What are those communities like? What are people talking about now, 9 months in?
You can hear the frustrations. I'm not getting this from my insurance company. You know, the cost of this is out of control. You know, all of these things that are prohibitive feelings that would allow you to rebuild. These things are holding people back, because it all starts with finances. Were you insured? Were you insured properly? Now, if you were insured properly, is the insurance company playing ball? You know? Like, it's literally, it's like a CD-ROM game. If you pick one, you go right or left, and then your experience is completely different. And so you can imagine 40,000 people and every choices they make, and you multiply that, extrapolate that out. And so, you know, I can only talk for our family. You know, everybody is in a different financial situation. That starts off everything. And so with that, then you can deal with, you know, how emotional it gets.
Sometimes it's easy for people skimming the headlines to kind of shrug if they're not there and say, well, you know, these are probably people's second houses, or they're wealthy anyhow, or, you know, I'm sure they're going to be fine, because if they're living there, they're fine. And obviously that's not the case, right? Everybody's in their own unique situation.
In my community, Altadena community, there's a lot of retirees. It's an older community. It was one of those communities that allowed for financing for minorities. So back in the 50s and whatnot. So it's a strong bedrock of minority home ownership. And so it's a very big deal, but it's an older community. And so we need to rebuild. And so we need to be supportive of each other, not, you know, trying to tear each other down again. But you're right. That's part of the concern with people in California, and the way the rest of America looks at us in terms of, they think, oh, these are all million-dollar homes. No, they're not. You know, these are just middle class, lower middle class folks.
Can you share, because I think a lot of people would be curious to know, especially if they've just gone through disaster, what is it that you did beforehand? Like, what was your thought process before to put you in that position? And now that you are reaping the benefits of it, what advice could you give about how to position yourself well for that?
Everybody needs to revisit their home insurance policy. If you bought your house longer than 4 years ago, 5 years ago, everybody needs to revisit. The price to rebuild the house in 1985 is not the same as 2025. So you're insured, but what happens is when the house burns down, you are insured for 180 grand. It costs 950 grand to build. Now you're in that group of people who, unlike me, are stressed. They don't know where to start and all that stuff. So that would be a first. How your insurance payout happened is probably the most critical aspect of how you are dealing with this disaster. Everybody I know that is in my situation, you would think it never happened. I mean, like, people talk to me all the time. They're like, I would never know you lost your house, man. You seem normal. You're just your normal self. You know, I'm like, because I'm not worried. I'm literally not worried. I am so squared away. People can't even make their first step. You know, that's like the design part. Be informed. This is part where, now this is pure luck. I've done a few residential flips. I've built construction from the ground up. So I know some of this process. And I knew what things cost. So I knew how to, I knew how to manage and deal with the bidding process of everything. So that is just me being fortunate. Right. So, whereas there's people right now who haven't even gotten past the design stage because everybody's telling these people it's going to cost you $165,000 in soft cost. And they're like, my budget is $600,000. I have $165,000 in soft cost. That leaves me a little over $400,000 to build a 1,500 square feet house. That's not going to happen.
As you work with your contractor, how's that been? And have there been moments where you've had to pull out that knowledge and kind of and say, kind of course correct a little bit and say, well, actually, I do know a little bit about this? I mean, how's it been going with, maybe you just found somebody really good.
I will tell people things that will make them know that I know certain things just so that when you send me your estimate, make it your best estimate.
You were saying there are people who don't even know, you know, they haven't even made the first call to the insurance. Like, they're so paralyzed with, I don't know what to do, right? Is that still the case? I mean, there's still people out there who just need this guidance of, what is the first step?
The only reason why people aren't rebuilding just yet is because, once again, it starts with finances. And then after that is knowing what you need to do and what you really don't need to do. And I'll give you a good example of that. You know, my house, we already had a floor plan drawn from my recent remodel. So I used a designer to draw up my entire new floor plan. That designer cost me $3,500. His engineer cost me $5,400. So between my designer, my engineer, my architect plans cost me less than 10 grand. And then you get these people on the forum. They're like, oh yeah, they're talking about, 8 to 15% of the project. So that of the project cost. So we're getting like 65,000, 80,000 in architect fees and 17,000 in engineering fees. And so now we're off 100 grand off the bat. This is where I have a problem. Because all these silly little expert consortiums that have popped up since the fires, teaching people what we need to do, they fail to tell people that if you pulled up a floor plan online that mimicked or kind of what you wanted and you gave it to a designer, they throw in the CAD machine and everything pops up for them. So you're saying, I paid $3,500 for something that somebody, my project is, let's say my project on a norm would cost 800 grand. So then do the math, 10% of 800 grand is 80,000.
Yeah.
And like, you know, that kind of stuff is heartbreaking to me.
One of the main reasons that Build SOS exists is to help people in the space that you're talking about, right? So we feel like, you know, we reach out, we try to understand what the needs are, develop apps, develop technology, how are we going to help these people to, I always say, to meet them where they are. What is needed? What is not out there right now? What do the people in this group need to just for help? How do we help them move forward? Like, what if you could snap your fingers, what technology would exist?
Anything that will help people through the initial. It's always the initial, because you're in pain, you know, there's trauma. You just want somebody to go, here, this is what you do. Don't make me think, don't make me search, don't make me look. Just put me in front of this group, and they're going to kind of walk me, hand-holding me through this initial process. Nobody fills you in on that first part. Nobody tells you, you know, oh, if you're homeless, this is who you need to reach out to. Nobody says that to you.
Have you actually gone out and like helped a neighbor kind of, you know, negotiate or talk to a contractor or talk somebody out of, you know, a 6-ton unit that should only be a 4-ton, that kind of thing yet?
Anybody I know that I talk to, that I touch on a daily basis that has anything to do with the fires, I ramble. And it's uninvited. I just start spewing out of the mouth. And hopefully you'll catch something that will save you a ton of money. Nobody's telling them that, you know, when you interview a GC, is he going to put a $150,000 site manager on the bill? You know, it's like, what is the GC for? Isn't that your job, as to be the site manager? You know, it's things like that. You know, it's more of the things you don't need. You know,
right?
People just don't know.
What's the easiest first step?
I think if there's a central resource where you can get some of those things, that would be a good start. They set up a one-stop shop for Altadena fire victims, and that they did the same for the Palisades. And so, and in Altadena one-stop, they've taken every department that you go through, the whole permitting process. Every department sits there, and so all in one place, you have all your answers. And it has been a godsend. Obviously, it's government run. And then what they decided to do was they decided to centralize the process for each group. So for Altadena, we have an office. For Palisades, they have an office. And in the office, you have your fire department. You have your building and safety. You have your planning. You have Southern California Edison. You have FEMA. You have all these people that you're going to have to talk to, right? And they're all there. And so it's one of those things where, like, I mean, you see it. I'm sitting there waiting. And then you hear these people ask these questions. And in the wrong department. And all they do is they shift the person down there. And then next you know, somebody walks out a little corridor. And they answer their questions. And it's a relief, right? Because when I'm dialing on the phone and I'm looking to find out an answer. And I'm feeling trauma. And then I get this, you know, dial one for this group. And then you dialed 7 times and nobody, you can't get to that group. And 45 minutes later, you don't have that one little question answered. And now you're thinking, if I have to do this with every question I have, I am going to jump off a bridge. If I have to, if it takes me 40 minutes for every question, I'm going to have a lot, because I have no idea about this process. I don't know where to start, where it ends, how we get into our house, how we get Southern California Edison to get us electricity because everything's burned. I don't know any of that. So I'm going to have a lot of questions, but if it's going to take me 40 minutes, I'm not going to do it.
It sounds like it's like the Home Depot, the one big box store for your permits, the recovery departments that you need to talk to. I mean, look, rest of the country, world, take note, because that's what you have to do.
This fire in Los Angeles specifically, right, will be a model for the rest of the world on how to manage a disaster of this large. The U.S. Corps of Engineers came in here and cleaned this place like it was a well-oiled military fighting machine. They rolled in, no questions asked, picked up stuff, dumped stuff. Moved. It was like ants, right? And the whole, and everybody is doing the same from top to bottom.
You know, I think more and more we're realizing in this world and in the United States and lots of places right now that everybody's kind of got to figure it out on their own more, and the government's not going to be there. It's going to be there less and less, I think, is the trend. A lot of these programs. And so you really have to lean on the private sector and your social network, which is so critical, unfortunately.
Yeah, we haven't felt like we lent on the federal government in that respect. It reminds me of my friend who, due to his own faults, became homeless. And I called my friend, who she and her family were homeless one time, and she was able to rattle off about 20 resources for him right off the bat. And I sat there and I was going, that's awesome. That's amazing. I didn't know these things existed. We need people to be able to just help people, which literally just the first couple steps is so critical to allow them to kind of get out of, take their own training wheels off and go, okay, I can handle the rest of the process. Because once you start getting into, you go, now it's just a matter of doing, because it's not nothing left to think about. It's just doing. That would be so critical.
Well, that's exactly what Disaster Diaries is doing. And that's exactly what you're doing, because you're telling your story. You're talking about, how you recover and how you go, take those first steps. And man, I love the fact that you're such an outspoken advocate. We're going to have you back, for sure. As the process goes on. But all right, I want to ask you a question to kind of wrap this up, which we ask everybody at the end of the podcast. What would you tell somebody who just found out they lost their house 5 minutes ago?
This is what I tell you. Have an amazing amount of grace for the people you're going to come into contact with, your family, and yourself with all of what you're about to go through in the next whatever, because it's going to be crazy. But if you can have a little bit of empathy and grace to recognize that everybody is going through it too, in their own ways, that we should be rowing in the same boat. And it will challenge the process if, we're fighting each other along the way.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much for muddling through this with us. So good luck with everything. Give the family a hug, guys. And we'll catch you on the rebound.
Thanks, guys.
Whoo, man.
Yeah.
As tragic as his story is, there was nothing but positivity about how he's come through it. He considers himself really fortunate. Obviously, he knows he is compared to a lot of other folks, and just out there trying to make a difference. And man, there was a lot of inspiration in that conversation.
Yeah, and absolutely. What struck me was that he has a combination of serenity and acceptance of the way things are, but he also still has his guard up and a healthy suspicion for the way things ought to be, right? So he's navigating this path of, okay, now I got to deal with this, right? Very Buddhist. Okay, now this. Like, this is what life is bringing me. But at the same time, he's saying, yeah, you don't need these services. You don't need this guy. Watch out for this one over here who's trying to take advantage. And he's not completely passive, but he's also not burning out all his energy, shaking his fist at the sky, right? It's, I think it's amazing. And also, I'm scribbling madly over here because I've got all these new ideas for Build SOS products in, 2026 and 2027. And I'm realizing from this conversation, and I'm realizing that what we can do is, as you and I continue to do this, Evan, we're going to be hearing, and we should probably start to ask, what do you need, right? What would have made it easier? What do you need right now? Because as we sit here and Build SOS and create solutions, we're creating them for these people. We're creating them for contractors as well, but also for the people who are saying, what next, right? And we should be pressure testing what we're building against the people who were going through it, right? Where did we hit? Where did we miss? What else can we do?
One thing that he said that really struck me was he's like, look, I'm a pretty dialed in guy. I mean, I know tech. I know the business a little bit, you know, around building and everything. He's like, but how many of these people are, you know, in their 80s or 90s or, you know, like they need to be served too. They need solutions in fact, maybe even more so, right? Because they need to be spoon-fed something that he's capable of going out and getting for himself because he's an able-bodied young guy who's ambitious and, you know, in the mix. And that's kind of the bar, I think, that we need to shoot for as far as, you know, what the community needs.
Yeah, there's a lot of good intentions out there that are not connected to what's actually needed or boots on the ground processes, right? And I think it would be best directed at what the actual need is, right? So rather than coming up with solutions on a whiteboard, you know, based on our extensive knowledge or learning or, you know, book learning, you need to get out there and actually say, is this working, right? We should begin with the end in mind. And I think that's a common problem with entrepreneurs as well that I've been guilty of, is you build something you just think is the most amazing thing ever. And of course, people are going to flock to this thing because it's amazing. And then nobody right. does. And you think, well, what's wrong with people? And yeah, it's not really what's wrong with people. It's you built something that wasn't needed, right? So,
you know, what he kept saying and what I keep hearing over and over again as we do these podcast interviews is information. You know, it's all the things they didn't know. And this is an opportunity to put it out there and hopefully in a good storytelling way that people want to listen to it, but then walk away with a, you know, a great tip or two. I mean, I know I've got a million things that I know I should be doing, filming my house and running my, you know, homeowner's policy in through the AI bot and making sure that I'm up to date and covered for everything for my area. All these things came from this. So this is the resource epicenter almost. Hey, thanks for listening to Disaster Diaries. And if you're moved by these stories, please like, subscribe, leave a review. That will really help us. And also, please share the show with somebody that you think needs it. To tell your own story, download the Disaster Diaries app, available at all app stores, or visit disasterdiaries.com. And if you're looking for help rebuilding, check out buildsos.com for support, tools, and resources to help you better prepare for, respond to, and recover from disasters. Hey there, just a reminder that this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not legal, financial, or insurance advice. Disaster Diaries and Build SOS do not endorse any specific products, services, methods, or guest viewpoints discussed here. So please, always consult qualified professionals for decisions related to disaster preparedness, construction, or insurance.